Henry II of England and his wife, Eleanor of Aquitaine, have created and ruled the Plantagenet Empire, the most dynamic, wealthiest, and most powerful kingdom in Western Europe. But the Plantagenets are rarely at peace, and Henry's temper and ego has long troubled his family and his people, from the shocking martyrdom of Thomas Becket to the vicious Great Rebellion that saw Eleanor sent to prison for 15 years. Meanwhile, their brilliant, avaricious, rebellious children have grown, fought, ruled, married, and even died, so that of his five sons, only two survive, Richard Lionheart and John Lackland. Now, as the 12th century enters its final decade, Henry himself dies, leaving his great legacy poised at the edge of great success or great failure. Here's the story of what happens as Richard and John take their turns on the Plantagenet throne.
Welcome back to Season 3 of Lion's Forge. My name is Becket, and I want to tell you a story, an epic true story of five kings and the Lion Queen. Season 3, Episode 5, The Luck of War. King Guy of Jerusalem, the humiliated warrior struggling to overcome the disaster at Hattin, had spent the winter in Tyre. Even though Tyre's ruler, Conrad of Montferrat, was distinctly unfriendly, Guy had not been idle. Shortly after the equinox, the 50 warships he had been outfitting were silhouetted against the western sky as they made their way toward Acres Harbor. They weren't alone. Another flotilla of 50 ships, the Muslim Navy, came to meet them. Naval warfare in 1190 wasn't a matter of standing well back and using big guns to pound away at a distant enemy. Instead, it meant getting close enough to damage rival ships with rocks and Greek fire, that medieval version of napalm, and picking off all possible targets, including the oarsmen, with arrows and lances, while maneuvering into boarding range. Once aboard, hand-to-hand combat would follow, thus neatly combining the threat of drowning with the ordinary concerns about being clubbed, slashed, or decapitated. The Battle of Acre Harbor was a close thing. Knights on foot on a foundering half-burned deck fought like madmen to keep from being thrown into the waves, while a Saracen ship nearby groaned to an end, run aground, crusaders standing in the tidal wash to slaughter the survivors. Many of those European troops had brought their families with them, creating a tent village north of the city. There's a story that when half-drowned Muslims stumbled ashore from a ruined ship, ferocious French and Italian women from the tents rushed them, stabbing and mauling, several holding a struggling Turk down while another clumsily sawed off his head. One crusader who saw it thought to mention in a letter that the women's physical weakness prolonged the pain of death because it took them so long to get the job done. The battle was scarcely an elegant success for the West, but it did force the Saracen fleet to flee for its survival into Acres Harbor, where it was bottled up. Now blocked by sea and by land from access to reinforcements and supplies, life for the Muslims inside Acre began to sink into an awful black and white fight for personal survival. The sick and wounded died. Women in childbirth died. Babies died. Children died. Old people died. Those who didn't die were terrified at the prospect of being forced outside the safety of the walls to reduce the number of mouths that had to be fed from failing supplies. Every animal that couldn't run or fly was killed for whatever bony protein it could give. Worst of all, there was no reprieve from the need to man the city's defenses day after day and night after night, even if you had eaten barely a mouthful since Monday. What it must have been like may be captured in the diary of a survivor of the horrific siege of Leningrad during the Second World War, who wrote,
"I have wanted to write down what a person emaciated from starvation experiences. It's difficult to perform any sort of physical movement, even the most insignificant. Before turning over in bed, you take a long time to gather your strength. You procrastinate, put it off. In your mind, you repeat the necessary sequence of actions over and over again before actually committing to them. The morning arrives, and it's very hard to overcome your inertia, to get up and get dressed."
Saladin tried repeatedly to break through the Crusader lines by land and sea, but his occasional success could not begin to slake the city's all-consuming need for unwounded men, clothing, medicines, new crossbows, leather sandals, unbroken cooking pots, and something to put in them. One clever Arab transport captain ran the sea blockade by pretending to man a European ship, going so far as to lash pigs to the deck in plain sight, since it was common knowledge that Muslims reviled pork. But even the ton of supplies his cunning brought in was gone as quickly as a drop of water on a red-hot stove. The Crusaders, on the other hand, were now having a better time of it. Once the battle for Acre's Harbor ended, fire-warped wreckage slowly washing up along the coast, there was little immediate fighting on either sea or land, except to repel Saladin's relief convoys trying to slip into the city. New shiploads of Europeans arrived almost daily, along with fresh horses, flocks of sheep, salt-crusted sides of beef, boots, arrows, chainmail, linen tunics, laundresses, priests, spear points, and letters from home. True, you risked being hit by a stone catapulted over Acre's walls. You risked dysentery from bad water. You risked running into a Saracen raiding party. But compared to existence in besieged Acre, things were going quite well. Best of all, you enjoyed the assurance that the real mass of the Crusader armies hadn't even crossed the horizon yet. As Saladin had feared for months, the Germans under Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa were on their way, rumored to number a 250,000 rested, equipped, and well-fed men. The Sultan was grim-faced, grappling with what seemed likely to be a murderous two-front war, just barely clinging to Acre in the south, while preparing to fight the immense European army expected any hour from the north. The Europeans in their tents outside Acre were still outnumbered by Saladin's men, and had to fight on two fronts themselves, one against Acre's walls, still somehow defended by starving Muslim archers and lancers, and one along the Crusader lines that snagged across the plain in front of the city, staring right into Saladin's army. But the Westerners had constant access to the sea, along with the happy conviction that Europe was sending a gigantic force of infantry, archers, and knights from every city, castle, and market town of a dozen countries. The Muslims had nothing like it to inspire optimism. Acre was so completely shut off that communication depended on carrier pigeons, considered national heroes for their loyalty and bravery, and on teenaged boys who slipped off the beach at night, swimming like seals for Acre's silent harbor. Pressure on Acre was crushing. The Europeans had spent the winter building siege machines, using wood shipped all the way from the forests of France. Some rose 5 stories, tall enough that archers riding on top could see over Acre's walls, and so state-of-the-art that they repelled Greek fire, thanks to being sheathed in hides toughened in vinegar brine. These menaces smashed their rocky missiles into Acre day and night, killing archers on the parapets and pedestrians in the streets below. On a particularly bad day, a beleaguered citizen of Acre would open his front door to find himself confronting incoming buckets of outraged snakes, flung across the walls with the compliments of crusaders who'd enthusiastically taken up this old Saracen tactic. Damage to the city's walls had to be repaired, while Crusader crossbowmen screaming curses took leisurely aim at the silhouetted workmen. Almost as nerve-wracking was the Europeans' determined labor to fill in the vast curving ditch, possibly 90 feet deep, that protected the exterior base of the walls from siege engines and tunnelers approaching too closely. This became such a single-minded Crusader goal that women and children from the family camp to the north of the city helped the soldiers, carrying anything they could lift. There is a story that one Crusader wife, mortally wounded by a defender's arrow, told the men to throw her corpse into the rubble. Acre's defenders were not completely helpless, although terribly hamstrung by starvation, exhaustion, and lack of supplies. The city had anti-siege equipment of its own, hulking catapults used to attack the Europeans and their siege machines. One was so powerful that it blasted rocks half a mile with a force that turned men and horses on the receiving end into so much ground meat. Saracen archers and lancers continued to man the walls, shooting anything that moved and screaming their own curses. Regardless, the Crusaders stubbornly went on their slow rock-hauling labor at the base of the walls. They got a section of the defensive ditch outside Acre filled in by the end of May and started moving their siege machines, teeming with archers and spearmen toward the city. Saladin and the city's commander, whose name was Karagush, could clearly see what was happening. Both were said to be in despair. Karagush, respected throughout the Middle East for his defensive skills, was seriously considering outright surrender. The miserable outcome to more than a year of truly heroic suffering, courage, and effort from the entire population. And then, it seems like the Crusades positively ripple with "and thens." On a desperate day, when Acre's surrender to destruction, slavery, and death seemed inevitable, an unnamed citizen petitioned to see Karagush, who probably was so tired and distracted that he simply said yes to everything. We don't know who the petitioner was. There's speculation that he was a coppersmith from Damascus. We do know he was a very talented amateur chemist. He had invented a new, improved version of Greek fire. One can't help but be fascinated by where and how naphtha in copper vats, among other ingredients, happened to be at hand in the stripped bare pantries of Acre. But it was. And Acre's re-energized catapults now shot clay pots filled with the new stuff at the towering European siege machines. Covered in their flame-proof sheaths, the Crusaders' towers had been unfazed by regular Greek fire, and the Crusaders were said to laugh dismissively when what must have looked like a wave of burning flower pots came over the walls. It soon turned out that they wouldn't be laughing as heartily as they might have liked. The new chemical worked fantastically well, setting siege towers on fire as soon as it hit, annihilating shrieking archers and spearmen who were trapped inside, 4 and 5 stories above the ground. Like all truly innovative war technology, there was no defense against it, something the Europeans didn't understand at first. For a while, they stubbornly tried building ever larger siege machines, which simply burned more spectacularly. Crusaders truly loathed the stuff, and there's a story that they got back at their cursed enemies when they captured a Turk who happened to be carrying a vial of it. They stripped him, staked him out, and poured the contents over him, concentrating on his privates while he screamed. One little death still known to us more than 800 years later. The Muslims' dreadful new weapon wasn't the only ugly reality confronting the once seemingly invincible Crusaders in that summer of 1190. They tried to take the Tower of Flies, men from Pisa lashing galleys together and building a wooden siege tower on top. Their invention was burned to the waterline by Acre's defenders. The Crusaders tried to break into Acre's harbor with fireships. The unruly wind shifted, pushing the flaming boats back into the European fleet. Even supplies were starting to become a problem. Food and equipment were more available to the Crusaders than to Acre's people, thanks to resupply from the sea. But they were not infinite in quantity or necessarily desirable in quality, especially as money began to run out. Some of these men had been outside Acre's walls for over a year by now. Even the wealthiest were feeling the pinch of want. Those who were poorer to start with, especially those with families to feed, began to starve. 5,000 of them died in late July when they mounted an inept attack on Saladin's camp trying to find food, leaving their corpses to bloat and burst in the summer heat. The Muslims again threw dead bodies by the hundreds into the little river, oily with clotted blood, that ran toward the Crusader settlement. The results were predictable. Europeans began to sicken, and the sicker they were, the worse the conditions in their stifling tents. Historian Thomas Asbridge says the surging mortality rate, even among the wealthiest nobles, turned Acre into the graveyard of Europe's aristocracy. Its effects on the great families of Europe would tumble across the decades to come. The mortality statistics historians have developed for this crusade are mind-boggling. There are estimates that as many as 3/4 of all Europeans who left their homes never returned. One great nobleman, Leopold of Austria, presumably able to command the best medical care to be had, saw 9 of the 10 men in his personal entourage buried in the Holy Land. Queen Sibylla of Jerusalem, wife of King Guy, died along with their 2 little girls. Frederick of Swabia, son of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa, after surviving the entire march from Germany to Acre, died at Acre Camp. Europeans endured uncountable tragedies as the siege of Acre sweltered on and on through the summer of 1190. But the most shocking was Frederick Barbarossa's. Nearly 70, this leader of the Holy Roman Empire was as tough as old boot leather, a warrior king who'd been fighting since he was a boy. Reports that he was bringing 250,000 soldiers were wild exaggerations, but he'd started out ahead of both Richard and Philip Augustus, leading somewhere in the neighborhood of some 30,000 highly disciplined German troops, whose restraint in comparison to their rowdy compatriots in the Second Crusade might be linked to Barbarossa's order that the unruly would have their throats cut. Discipline served them well. They made excellent time coming south. They couldn't avoid the normal troubles of any army on the march, struggling with hunger, thirst, fatigue, and Muslim attacks that snatched at men and horses. But things went well for Barbarossa's forces until a day in June 1190, about the same time the Saracens were in agony of fear that Acre was about to fall. While crossing the Salif River near the southern coast of contemporary Turkey, Barbarossa drowned. We don't know how it happened, since the stories that come to us variously say that after he impatiently refused to wait to cross a bridge, he slipped while fording the river. His horse threw him while fording the river. He fell from his horse after a heart attack, or he had a heart attack while in the cold water. Weighed down by his armor, he died. Absolute disbelief must have clutched at the throat of every German who saw it happen or heard the story gasped by a messenger. The great leader is gone. One heartbroken poet wrote that the Star of the Rhine had fallen from the heavens. From that very minute, everything would be different, all at once, with no time to plan. Barbarossa's son, Frederick of Swabia, 23 years old to his father's 68, immediately took charge. His very first act was to have his father's body recovered by tough infantrymen, who must have cried as they slowly carried it to the riverbank. Some of the Germans were so distraught they committed suicide. Others renounced their faith and gave themselves to the Muslims, convinced that God must have abandoned Christianity for such a dreadful thing to happen. Barbarossa himself would never make it home. His corpse would be inadequately embalmed and would stay forever in the Outremer. Even with their morale fractured, the Germans had little choice except to march unsteadily on toward Acre. The new commander, lacking his father's immense experience, decided to split the army into smaller units to make foraging easier. The Saracens, who had also heard of the great man's death, slashed in and out of the thin German lines, killing and maiming. Diseases came, dysentery no doubt, malaria and other fevers besides. If you weren't dead and you weren't sick, desertion held genuine appeal as an option. The Germans were on the road for 4 more months. By the time Frederick of Swabia reached the Crusaders' camp, he had lost as much as 80% of his army. Ever since, the question of what might have happened if Barbarossa had lived to join Richard Lionheart and Philip Augustus has teased historians. As it was, the German disaster was so terrible in this age that attributed everything to God's will that people back home began to seriously question why a just God had allowed this mammoth blow to fall on God's soldiers, making their way to the Holy Land to fight God's war. To their credit, no matter how dazed by what happened to them during those months, the Germans had successfully accomplished one critical job. They kept Saladin off balance, convincing him he needed to be ready to grapple with Barbarossa's supposedly huge army. By the time the Germans joined their allies outside the city, it was mid-October. Perhaps elated by facing a far smaller force than he had feared, perhaps pressed by the desire to finally end the Acre deadlock, Saladin tried a major assault, clashing hard with the Crusaders near Jaffa. Neither side could claim a win. It was mid-November by now, an entire year spent and gone. Saladin sent his army home for the winter. He left both the city's defenders and their determined enemies shackled to their perfect stalemate. His men could rest. Everyone else could face a second winter on the plains of Acre. We've come to the end of our story for the time being. I am Beckett Arnold, narrating from the book Lion's Forge, adapted for us by the author Karen Markle Knapp. Thank you to Francis Butt for voicing our introduction and so much more. If you like what you hear, please give us a rating, follow our channel, and share us with your friends. Most importantly, please join us again November 18th for the next episode of Lion's Forge. Available everywhere you get your favorite podcasts, including on YouTube with video episode trailers. Visit us on Facebook, where you can ask questions, leave reviews, and interact with me. Until next time, thank you for listening.